also review and adjust agency budgets, quote, to advance the president's policies and priorities, close quote. Congress first set up the agencies specifically to act independently or semi-independently from the president. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
سألت القدس على أولادها قولوا لها أولادك بالشيخ جراح، وإن سألت غزة على نهارها قولوا لها ما ضل إلا النزاح، إن سألت القدس على أولادها قولوا لها أولادك بالشيخ جراح، إن سألت غزة على نهارها قولوا
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Lamin with the Shayunana Show. And with me today, helping me pitch, because we're on a fun drive right now at WPFW, is Netfa Freeman. Thank you, Netfa, for joining me.
Hey, brother. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
First of all, I just wanted to let you know that the song you just heard is Naib Arghouti, and it's a fitting song because it's titled Raj'een, which means we're returning. And she sings about returning to basically to Jerusalem and returning to Gaza and rebuilding and planting the land, which is what is happening right now, despite the fact that that the ceasefire is being is being not obeyed. There's been openly a break in the ceasefire by Israel, and threats by Netanyahu, saying that they're giving them a deadline by this weekend to release the hostages. And despite the fact that he's admitting that he's breaking the ceasefire, he still wants the hostages to be released. I think that this kind of a bold statement at this point, when the whole world is condemning Israel, including allies like Jordan and Egypt, in terms of not agreeing to displacing the Palestinians into their lands. It's very fitting right now that this is what's happening right now. I wanted to, first of all, I wanted to state what our goal is for fundraiser, which is $600. You can, in order to make a donation, if you're listening to me now, you can call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. You can also call, or rather get online and go to wpfwfm.org and make a donation. Go to the donate button and go to the Shai Nana show and make a donation there. Also, I believe Netfa, we still have the Cash App, right?
Yeah, we still have Cash App, and that is WPFWFM, just dollar sign WPFWFM, and then you can Cash App whatever you want. And we encourage people to put Shaiwa Nana in the memo field when you do it, just to make sure that the show gets the credit for it.
Excellent. So please do call that number or get online and make a donation. We have we actually stopped the program before October 7 of last year, and I had overwhelming coursework back then. But then, as soon as, of course, the invasion of Gaza and the ethnic cleansing started, we had to return to the airwaves and focus. And we've been focusing on Gaza for the last 15 months, on regular basis, weekly basis, curating the best of the dispatches that are happening from all over the world about what's happening in Gaza. So it's all been about all about Gaza. And of course, we haven't, today's one of the first days we actually play music. Which we usually do. We've been mourning the deaths, and we have a tradition in the Arab world that when people die for 40 days, you don't listen to music. So, and that's been renewed, of course, as you know, Netva, been renewed day by day.
You're right. Yeah. This is a very heinous thing that's happening, and actually, it feels sort of, I don't know. I'm ambivalent about whether we should think of it as shameless, but it's not. The WPFW and Shaiwa Nana, it becomes more vital in times like these when real, standing up to real, serious powers, seriously heinous and genocidal powers. We have to be able to have communications outlets and shows that, like Shaiwa Nana and WPFW, that will have a show like that, like this. We have to keep up. This we have to keep it going. If we don't support it, it's not going to, it will lose it. It only gets supported by people, you, the listeners. And we also are making a special appeal to the people who listen regularly but don't support. We know that's a significant number of people, unfortunately. And we want to appeal to you to step outside of that category and become one of those who make the contribution that are actually being the these those who sustain the station. And speaking of that term, sustain, The goal for the show is $600, and it really would help Zane and Shawanana if people did chunks of the goal. Like if you could do 100, the sustainer thing means that you don't have to do it all at once. You can actually stretch it out for over a year. You could do 100, 120, and what's, you know, my math is really bad, Zane. So 120 times 12, that's $10 a month, is it? Is that right? Am I doing that wrong? Yeah, that's $10 a month.
That's right.
So $10 a month you could give, and then it would still count to the goal today. And then of course, people, this is hard times for everybody. You don't even have to do that. If you could do 50, you know, if you could do 25, it all counts to the goal. But I think it's more important, very important for this show to reach the goal more than ever, considering the times that we're in, that Zane is able to articulate and whoever else, because I know you also have co-hosts sometimes. I mean, I listen, I catch it when I can, and I'm very impressed with the show and proud of this show, because it helps you, the pride in WPFW with a show like this. The forethought that is because I just, and I want to take my hat off again to our program director, Katia Stitt, who saw that a show like this was needed, that deals with this area of the world that is not, I don't know of any show like this, quite frankly, that's on the radio. And maybe, Zane, you're more familiar, you might be able to, you know, tell whether how unique it is or not, but definitely not in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. and the DMV, this, Shawanana, is the only show that will bring you voices directly from the front lines in the, I don't want to say, what's the Middle East, that kind of term is sort of, seems to be Western designation, but Palestine, Israel, although the, you know, Asia, I guess is that term, and that will give you voices from the front line, will give you the, like Zane said, there's artistic expression here. That is cultural, reflective of the culture of the area, and it's also political and socializes people. But I don't want to take up too much time, Zane. I just wanted to add that in there.
Thank you, Nitfa. And just one last thing before we go to our segment, and we'll return in about 20 minutes or so, and again pitch again in case people missed the beginning. But when I went to Standing Rock, Netva, and to do solidarity work with Native Americans, I wrote in my first day that we should always follow those whose sight has long adjusted to the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And we know Native Americans have been, you know,
that's right,
have been in, you know, put in the dark and can see through the dark, and that's what this show is about. We right now we have a double whammy. We had 15 months of genocide, and now it's escalating, where the attack is both international and domestic. And when we said that the Palestinian issue is the litmus test for global justice, this is exactly what we meant, is that these are people that whose sight has long adjusted to the dark and can see through that and can see us through to the end of the tunnel, basically. So we are seeing the connections that have happened over the last 15 months with all kinds of struggles, whether it is domestically, whether it's about police brutality, whether it's about Sudan internationally, whether it's about any of the countries that where there's been U.S. imperialism, where they can relate to what's happening in Palestine, and we have a whole new generation rising now. And what's unique about having this show is that we depend on you. We don't depend on corporations, and so we're less susceptible to censorship because we depend.
That's right.
People, real people, not corporations, and not that's our focus, basically. And they've been trying to censor everything, including TikTok and Instagram and Facebook. We know that censorship is going on, But I always say Netva is that they go high, meaning high tech, we go low.
That's right. That's right. That's how you get it. That's how you have to do it. You know, that's how you, people don't, let me, should we say the phone number real quick before you please, do the 202? This is how you call in your pledge. That's the most favorite way, is calling it in. 202-588-9739. Their operator standing by to take your contribution, to walk you through it. 202-588-9739. The other second most favorite way is to go online, WPFWFM.org. There's a donate button at the top left corner, and then that will also give you prompts, and you can make a comment. Either way, you can make a comment. We can read it on the air. We like to thank people on the air and give you kudos. You could, we'll thank you either way. You can also be anonymous and just let us know your comment that way.
Thank you, Netva. So we're going to have a listen. Some of you have might have heard of a Palestinian activist who's now, I believe, in New York, Muhammad al-Kurd, who at 9 was basically, his house was occupied by settlers in Jerusalem. And he is about to release his second book. The first book was a book of poetry, and he's about to release the second book, which is really important, and it's called Perfect Victims. And it's such an important thing, because they, what he talks about is they want Palestinians and Arabs in general to be perfect victims, you know, to be submissive and bend to the pressure, phrase things in such a way so it's not really effective in a struggle for liberation. So he's having a conversation here with Randa Abdel Fattah about this specific topic, which is going to be, I think, this conversation, which happened a while ago, is what might have inspired him to write this new upcoming book, Perfect Victims. So let's have a listen.
Hi, this is Muhammad al-Kurd. Today I spoke with Dr. Randa Abdel Fattah, who is an academic novelist and the author of many, many books that have been translated into many languages. She recently published an essay with Mondawise called On Zionist Feelings. We spoke about my favorite topic in the world, which is Zionist feelings, and how discussions of sentiments and semantics are often elevated over the systemic, institutional, and material reality of violence and colonialism that Palestinians are subjected to. Please take a listen. Hi, Randa. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I appreciate your time. I've read your essay in Mondawise, about not wanting to assuage, not wanting to coddle Zionist feelings. And I really resonated with this essay, because in the past few weeks, really in the past few months, it's felt like we are living in some kind of fever dream, one where you see people getting bombed, you see people take their last breaths on the middle of the street, you see fathers and mothers collect the remains of their children. And on the other side of the world, the conversations are largely about somebody else's feelings. Somebody who is usually in a high-rise apartment, who enjoys rights and privileges that the Palestinian people have never enjoyed. Can you speak to me a little bit about your experiences with these things, particularly in Australia?
Yeah, well, I wasn't really incited to write that article from the frustration that I was feeling at really from one particular thing that had happened, which was the lighting of like iconic buildings around the world, but here in so-called Australia, with the Israeli flag in solidarity with Israel. And then the natural response of Palestinians after that happened was to hold protests, to mark the escape from the hostage situation in Gaza, the breaking free, and to express that this was a moment in which Palestinians were going to assert their right to self-determination and to liberation, and to then be met with governments lighting buildings with the Israeli flag at the same time that they were expressing these, you know, outpourings of emotion and grief. And the emotional language that was used was really striking to me. The almost, you know, the weaponization of grief and tears and outrage and shock and horror with the colonizer and the oppressor. And we can unpack why that seemed to be so much more heightened now because there had been resistance. But for me, what was so shocking about this as well was that our grief as Palestinians was never, ever acknowledged or validated. And not only that, when we dared to protest about the fact that we have never had anything lit up in our names, we were the ones who were offending Jewish Zionists' feelings. We were imposing and encroaching on their spaces of mourning. We were daring to grieve when they should have had the space to grieve. And it was just this inversion of victim and victimized that just drove me crazy. And then I started to notice, or we started to notice as advocates, that every time Palestinian protests and marches have been reported on in the media, it has always been juxtaposed with a rise in anti-Semitism, or it's always been juxtaposed with how the Jewish community is feeling about these protests. And then there will always be some soft story about a Jewish person in a community who feels that it's becoming a much more unsafe place to live and to grow. And, you know, they're feeling under siege and isolated. And this blurring, it's almost this attempt to equate the feelings of the colonizer and the colonized. And all of this was, you know, compounded by more and more stories coming out of, you know, the community, the Jewish community, expressing, you know, shock and horror that they've never felt so unsafe. They've never felt so isolated or marginalized, and the security risk. And even reports that the only place that they feel free would be to go back to Israel, to go and live in Israel. And no sense of irony in the reporting on this. And just the complete erasure of Palestinians' feelings, grief, you know, what we are going through. And that's why I wanted to unpack this, because we know that there is a lot of reticence to even attempt to challenge the idea that we should hold space for Jewish Zionist feelings. I do not believe that I should. I believe, in fact, that it is my duty to make them uncomfortable. I am quite happy for them to feel, you know, that they are not in a space where they can safely articulate that they believe that my people should be under a genocide, should be killed. Surely that should not be a controversial proposition, and yet it is.
It's interesting because this is precisely the idea that we should hold space for Zionist feelings comes from this concept that Zionism could mean different things to different people. This is always brought up. It's particularly by Zionists or liberal Zionists. It's always brought up that, yeah, I mean, yeah, this is like this is a settler colonial movement. It's racial elimination, it's expansion, it's occupation. But to us, it's self-determination. To us, it's like decolonization. To us, it could hold these different multitudes. And I find that infuriating. I find it insulting because Zionism has told us once and time and time again what it is on the ground. We see it in the systemic policies. We see it. We see the way it's operating on the ground. But what you're talking about, to me, strikes me as this kind of elevation of the sentimental, of the semantic, right? The feelings of the colonizers or those sympathizing with the colonizers over the systemic conditions under which we live as Palestinians. And that is the most bizarre thing, but that seems to be the condition of the world. You know, there's a protest in Australia or there's a protest in London, and the headline about this protest is about a certain chant that is screamed at the protest, not about what the protest is protesting in the first place, right? The bombs, the American-made, European-financed bombs dropping on the Gaza Strip. When you say that you reject this, when you say that you reject this coddling, right, this demand that you coddle these feelings, how does this look materially? How do we reject?
we have to keep pushing back. And I think there's, for me, I hold the most contempt for progressive liberal spaces. You know, I know what I'm dealing with the right, the far right, but I see these ones as sort of the Diet Coke of the far right, you know, like we can really unpack like these grand abstractions that they make about say, free speech and, the marketplace of ideas and, you know, polite, respectful debate. We know that. I mean, you unpack it beautifully in all your essays and in your interviews. But for me, there has been like the cumulative effect of the progressive space offering these shields to Zionists for so many years in universities, in liberal media, has brought us to this point. It's brought us to a point where they have wrapped cotton wool over the Jewish Zionist industry so thick that it has made it very hard for us to penetrate through that. And your essay, you wrote this amazing, I remember reading it when I was at Palestine Rights in September in the airport, at the horrific LA airport, waiting in transit. And I read your essay looking at, the idea that we are constantly held to this standard of understanding, you know, years and years of European anti-Semitism and the labels and the imagery, as if somehow we need to understand all of that history and then become advocates. But I remember reading that and thinking, you know, the reason why we are here is because that liberal so-called space where there is this debate and ideas has never interrogated Zionism the way it does any other, you know, racist, supremacist political ideology. It's never afforded it that same treatment. And that's why there's this panic. There's this panic at actually using like the normative tools that we do to unpack racist ideologies in the same way that we would for other ideologies when it comes to Zionism. And that's why you have this, you know, like you said, this bizarre situation or this ludicrous situation where we can actually allow Zionists to dictate to us what Zionism means. You know, whatever dictionary they want to use, whatever feelings they have about what it means to them. You know, I've met people who say, I'm a cultural Zionist. You know, at the end of the day, I don't care how you define. It's like me, honestly, walking up to a white supremacist and saying, so tell me, what does white supremacy mean to you? And I did that for my PhD. I actually looked at Islamophobia from the point of view of Islamophobes and interviewed them and sat down with them and tried to unpack what was the thinking there. But I never actually, you never did that with the intention of validating or normalizing their rhetoric and their claims. It was to interrogate it. And that's what the left has never seriously done. It's just accepted at face value what Zionists claim and doesn't have the courage to say, well, actually, no. You can't tell me that cultural Zionism is about equality for all when you have an apartheid system, or that this is about self-defense when you've killed 30,000 people in 2 months. You know, so there's no integrity truth-telling here in even the pursuit of wanting to come to a situation where we can actually say there are some ideas and ideologies that don't have a right to speak on behalf of themselves, because we look at what they're doing in their name on the ground, like you said, the material reality.
And it's precisely this that I love the analogy to white supremacy, because it's it feels like a no-brainer when you talk about white supremacy. I also recently said something about it being similar, you know, like the whole conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, and saying that if you're anti-Zionist, then you're anti-Semitic. Oftentimes we have the time to listen and to sit with these questions, and we have the time to defend ourselves and say, no, actually, this is not the case, and blah, blah, blah. And a lot of the times we give weight to these accusations. Meanwhile, if you accuse, you know, somebody who believes in anti-racism of being anti-white, that's, you get scoffed at. That's just not real. That's not a real thing. Or if you accuse a feminist of misandry, that is hilarious. It's not a real accusation. But what these accusations reveal, and what this kind of inversion of reality reveals, as you said, is the primary goal of Zionism. And it's been so successful because it's been situated outside of history, so to speak. It's been so exceptionalized. We are able to look at everything with scrutiny except for Zionism. And you wrote in your essay, your aim is to expose what is unsaid in the public sphere. And what is unsaid is the following, that Jewish Zionists demand Palestinians and those who support Palestinian self-determination to be silenced, that we collectively tolerate Zionist racism as a gesture towards atonement for the violence of European anti-Semitism, that we allied 75 years of violent occupation to assuage settler death and suffering on October 7th. Yep. I found those lines particularly compelling because they say the quiet part out loud. It's the idea that we are going to put aside all of our suffering and elevate Jewish suffering or Zionist, I would argue Jewish suffering, because that's how they promote it. This is how it's promoted on a national institutional level, to elevate their suffering above our own, as though we are still living in the time where, you know, in the time where the Holocaust was happening. We are past this time. You know, the tables have turned, the power dynamics have shifted. The Israeli regime is one of the world's superpowers. It is the only nuclear regime in the Middle East. And yet, despite this might, despite this power, despite this sophistication, this technological advancement, despite being one of the richest countries, one of the most supported, uplifted, amplified countries, it still gets to be also a victim on the world stage. And that is absurd.
It's so absurd, and it leads to the scenario where there's this hypersensitization to Jewish feelings, because we don't want to offend them because they're still the victims of the Holocaust. Like it's like the image is forever, you know, the status of Holocaust victim is just, it will continue forever. And yeah, like you said, it completely, completely denies what is happening on the ground and that the power dynamic has changed. And also that, the power imbalance, you know, the reality of life for Palestinians. But also that hypersensitization, what makes it so obscene is it's happening at the same time as the desensitization to Palestinians being slaughtered every single day. And we don't, I mean, just from the last, you know, since 8th of October, we have this heightened environment in which everybody is so quick to not offend the Jewish community who are feeling under siege because Israel is in the news again. People are protesting against Israel and we just feel so under attack. And all these politicians are out there reassuring the Jewish community that we are here for you, that we will fight anti-Semitism, that we will increase laws. We've had this conversation here in New South Wales, in Australia. We will strengthen laws to protect you. And at the same time that this is happening, what makes it so obscene is this complete desensitization to the fact that every day Palestinians are losing their lives. And you can even break it down further, like look at, for example, university spaces. So university spaces are now, and you know, like for example, you know, the Harvard president who was forced to resign, first Black president, you have university spaces, and we have a similar situation here where the absolute censorship on Palestinian advocacy is happening. At the same time, and we have these conversations about how Jewish students aren't feeling safe and we need to address anti-Semitism on campus. Meanwhile, the University of Gaza is bombed. Palestinian professors and students are being slaughtered. We could literally create genres of obituaries, you know, journalists we could create. And the media, again, we have to protect Jewish feelings. Meanwhile, you have destroyed the media industry in Palestine. So it's, again, it's this constant juxtaposition of these obscenities. And again, like I was saying before, it's because I believe very strongly that the progressive left need to be held to task for being the shield that has allowed this to really fester and fester, so that now we are at a situation where there's literally a genocide happening and we cannot even protest against it without, like you said, our political demands being reduced to emotions, our political demands being reduced to we hate Jews. One of my favorite things that you've written about is, again, that essay where you unpack this idea that we cannot even talk about what Jewish versus Zionism. We have to constantly make these disclaimers. And you said it, you know, yourself about how feminists are never demanded, have never have to make those disclaimers. As Palestinians, we always have to do that. And it gets tiring. And it becomes almost sometimes it feels like we end up validating that dichotomy. Why should we do the hard work when we know that it serves the Zionist lobby for that entanglement to stay extremely tricky and confused, because it shields them, because it scares people. And those who can make that distinction don't want to. One of the examples you gave was when the Star of David was literally burned into a Palestinian's face. And the Star of David is a really good example. I remember in the first weeks here, we had Palestinian students were creating counter protests, flyers with images of children. And they were kind of looking the same as the flyers that the Jewish Zionist students were planting all over universities. And they had put the Israeli flag at the top with some blood dropping. There was mass panic within the Palestinian advocacy community. We can't do this. We're going to be accused of anti-Semitism. Like, it's their panic. Have we really come to this? Have we come to this situation where we are doing damage control preemptively using their symbols? It's not on us.
Yeah, it's self-censorship. It's absolutely self-censorship, right? It's like you are whipped into like perfecting every syllable that comes out of your mouth. You are trained to like perform for an audience. This is also the chasm between Arabic and English, because in English we are anticipating, we are waiting to see. We almost know how the audience is going to react, and so we don't talk about the material conditions. We don't talk about the occupation before we talk about denouncing all the things they want us to denounce, before making sure we don't confirm any of their biases. And this is precisely the point of all of this, is to be distracting, is that we lose time instead of talking about the occupation, instead of talking about the siege. We lose time talking about hypotheticals and abstractions and what's offensive and what's not offensive. Meanwhile, again, there is bombs dropping. But this is, again, precisely the point, is to be distracting. And I think we don't need to be distracted by these things. We don't need to give them weight, because it's not my fault. It's not your fault. This is the thing that drives me the most insane, is that you have a state that actively, willingly, explicitly desecrates Jewish symbols for its own enterprise. And then the weight of sanitizing that desecration falls on you as a subject, as a colonized subject, as an occupied person. It's not my fault they march around with uniforms that have the Stars of David on them. It is not my fault that they plant the Star of David at the heart of the massacre. It is not my fault, and it's not my responsibility. You said something at the very end of the essay. You said, enough, khalas. And I think this, yani, is the heart of where I think we all need to head at, as a Palestinian movement, as the left, as people who believe in human dignity, who believe in resistance, and who believe in all of these so-called progressive things. We can no longer tolerate this. It is absolutely, completely ridiculous and bizarre that we are yet having these discursive discussions about what is and what isn't offensive linguistically, what is and what isn't offensive psychologically. Meanwhile, you have 6 million people who have absolutely no rights, and that is treated as the status quo. But I believe this is rooted entirely in racism, right? You talk a lot about how our right to grief is robbed from us, let alone our right to rage and our right to resist and our right to armed resistance or violent resistance and so on are robbed from us. Meanwhile, their violence is not only celebrated and mourned and have the Eiffel Tower lit up in their colors, but it's institutionalized and it's perfectly legal. It is perfectly legal. And I think this comes down to race, to the idea that we are not seen by these actors, by the world's superpowers, as human beings. And thus we are not offered or allowed the right to mourn or the right to grieve, and our lives simply mean less than their lives do. And when you say khalas, you are saying that you refuse to exist in this world order anymore. You refuse to accept the status quo as the norm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I take a lot of my sort of, I trained, like I cut my teeth on activism really with 9/11 because I'm from that generation. And in the beginning of 9/11, we were condemning. We do not condemn terrorism. That was our reflex because we were so scared that this was about, we didn't understand we didn't have racial literacy. We lacked the racial literacy to understand this in its broader context. We actually thought this is because they don't understand Muslims. They misunderstand us. If only if they read the Quran, if only we did more interfaith gatherings, if only they understood who we were, then they wouldn't hate us and call us terrorists. And of course, you know, you learn very quickly. It doesn't matter how much you condemn. That is never going to be the point. And it's the same here. It does not matter how there is a point at which you no longer frame and articulate your political agenda and demands and your vision and aspirations through a white gaze, through the gaze of how is the other going to accept this? How can I, like you said, sanitize this in a way so that they will come on board? No, part of being part of a liberation movement is to now say we will determine the terms of reference on which we will assert our right to independence and self-determination. And I think we're seeing that it took 30,000, you know, and going for the progressive Accept Palestine, the PEPs, for a lot of them to wake up. That's another interview altogether, another conversation altogether about the rage I feel about that, because I feel that there are so many people who have come on board now who have, through their silence, been complicit in the conditions, the discursive conditions that we are up against, which have prevented us from being humanized, that have allowed this dehumanization to occur. And I'll give you one example of this, which is very current, which is the mass rape claims. How quickly they spread, like it was like wildfire, because the racist discursive conditions were there. They were primed to believe that the Arab bestial, savage, predatory male, despite the absolute ludicrous, like, fantasy of that, just the New York Times article alone, which was quickly debunked, you know, and the people that I saw on my Instagram feed, people who had been posting about Palestine were suddenly withdrawing their support. You know, because how could they not acknowledge, you know, these mass rape claims? And the reason that they lost their intellectual prowess for those moments is because they had been primed for so long to believe this. Of course, the Arab male is going to interrupt, you know, this mass, you know, operation to gang rape a woman, you know, and to commit these absolutely disgusting, obscene, violent acts, which was so clearly to anybody who understands the way that rape is weaponized against brown and black communities in service of empire, quickly would see through. And yet they were primed to do that because they didn't do the work all those years before to challenge this racism. And we, you know, we're constantly saying this, reducing this to an issue against Jews serves the Zionist agenda, and it robs us of the intellect and the political, you know, the politics of what we are fighting. This is not about emotion. It's not about interpersonal hatred of Jews. Most Palestinians have spent less time thinking about Jewish people as a Jewish people than...
If you're just tuning in, this is the Shayan Nana show, and you're listening to an interview conducted by Muhammad Al-Kurd, the Palestinian activist and writer and poet, and he is interviewing Randa Abdel Fattah, who's in Australia, about this topic of being the perfect victim, how Palestinians have been asked to be perfect victims and to apologize for the assault, for the genocide that they're being subjected to, because it's making their attackers feel unsafe. So And I just wanted to note something that as a child growing up in South Lebanon, the first time I saw the Star of David was on a plane that broke the sound barrier over my boarding school and broke every window in the building above us. And we managed to run away as the rain of glass came down on us. So we always associated the Star of David with violence instead of associating it with Judaism, which actually these kinds of actions go against Judaism. So that's what I wanted to add to this conversation. So things that you're not going to hear this kind of analysis anywhere else. And like Netfa said earlier, people always tell me that there is no show like this that focuses.
Whether it's the courage to tell the truth about displacement, apartheid, and genocide, or our commitment to presenting jazz and all of its extensions, as well as other liberatory musical forms, blues, hip-hop, house, WPFW has been an unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of the culture. Now's the time for you to display your courage and commitment to truly independent press by donating during our winter pledge drive from February 9th through the 22nd. It is with your generous financial support that WPFW, this emancipatory educational media outlet, continues to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, "I support jazz and justice," without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Yeah, we had the disruption here in the Zoom. But I wanted to give the numbers for our fund drive here at WPFW. And the first thing, if you can call 202-588-9739 and make a donation there. There's operators waiting to take your call. And the another way, and I know people across the nation and maybe internationally tend to listen online to the show. And if that's the case, you can also go make a donation by going online to WPFWFM.org and go to the donate button and then go to the Shai Nana show and make a donation there. Also, we have a Cash App, which is $ WPFW. That's $ WPFWFM. Is it FM?
The Cash App, yes, WPFWFM. And I don't know if you were able to see the person that broke the ice and gave you a contribution already.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, John Hall in Washington, D.C., broke the ice. We still got a lot to go, though, and not much time. And we know that there are people out there who support the show. That was a very interesting conversation. I wish we had more time to talk about it than that cognitive dissonance and that, you know, that sensitivity by the colonizers over the interest and the humanity of the colonized and the those being genocide being committed against. And anybody who can really identify with being a colonized people can see some other form of that in so many ways. I don't want to, you know, hijacking conversation, but I was just so, I was hoping we could get to talk of that, because right now you're seeing, and I'm not disparaging anybody who's, you know, who's concerned about these federal jobs and all that being, you know, under assault by the Trump administration, but it's odd to see people like these legislators like Hakeem Jeffries and whatnot out there, and all of them out there with these people, and not talking anything about this declaration of war against the redeclaration or intensification of war and the and the violation of the ceasefire against the Palestinians, what's about to come. None of that, because they all supported it during the Biden administration. And so, and then I, you know, anyway, I had so much so many thoughts listening to that, being on the campuses and the news showing some, you know, what was supposed to be a Jewish student talking about, I feel unsafe. And they're in the midst of the encampment, no one doing anything to them, no one saying they had to be there, talking about they feel unsafe. Some of that, that's what it reminded me of, hearing that conversation and how they brilliantly unpacked the psychopathy around that.
Right, and it's part of that is also invisibilizing, ignoring the fact that a huge section of Jewish students are actually pro-Palestinian.
That's right.
We've had a huge consciousness on this. So who is feeling unsafe? You know, it's a minority, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Majority of Jewish youth support, you know, and I teach at several universities, and I see it on campuses. I think this is a really important analysis about victimhood and how to be a perfect victim. And when later on, when we have Muhammad al-Kurd releasing his book, Perfect, mm-hmm. we'll have him on to talk about
this. Good. I was going to ask you if you knew them. You knew him and other Rhonda.
Yeah. I didn't know Rhonda, but I knew Muhammad al-Kurd. In fact, we hosted him at American University. And speaking of feeling unsafe, when Zionist entities at the university pushed him out, you know, they wouldn't let him speak on campus. Our beloved Reverend Hagler hosted him, and Reverend Hagler, speaking of feeling unsafe, Reverend Hagler received threats for hosting
that.
So he actually had to call the police to be parked in the parking lot, because people were calling their office and saying, We're going to disrupt this thing. And he didn't. Mm-hmm. He had just assumed that there's going to be violence. So this is how this topsy turvy world
is. It isn't it? But we need we want to thank Zane. You see, if you see, there's a Brigitte Rousson from Washington. Also, we know Brigitte is a big friend of WPFW and the movement in general, but also we need to finish out with having reached this goal. So we still have quite a bit to go. 202-588-9739. Also WPFWFM.org, go online. These are the two favorite ways, because we can thank you right away and tell the listeners whether or not the goal is received. Is WPFWFM.org, and then 202-588-9739, and go through the prompts. And that, you know, like we say, you could stretch out, become a sustainer. If you want to, if you can do a big chunk of money, you can become a sustainer and help that way. And or, you know, if you can do just 25, just 50, whatever you can do is going to help this station that would have this type of information and programming that Zane brings you selflessly every day. And Zane, if I'm not mistaken, you don't get a salary or anything from WPFW, is that right?
No. I do this for free, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing it for 7 years now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Excellent program.
And I wanted to repeat what Netfa said, and thank John and Brigitte for their donations. And we have a modest goal of $600. So hopefully, again, no donation is too small and no donation is too large. So help us get close to our goal as much as possible in these last few minutes. Again, 202-588-9739, WPFWFM.org, if you want to do it online. And for Cash App, it's $WPFWFM.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then don't forget, this is, we got one more minute to go. Is that it? One more minute to go. And so, yeah, I don't know if you had any, thank you for, it's always an honor and a pleasure, brother. We go back before, like, to the 90s.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it was your idea and Katia's idea to do this show.
Well, it was Katia's idea, and she asked me, and I thought of you.
Yeah.
That's how it went.
Yeah. And it's such a privilege to do this.
I knew you would do great. You've been doing great, man. You know.
Again, 202-588-9739. Please give us a call. Make a donation. WPFWFM.org.
There we go. Thank you, Carolyn in Silver Spring. Keep it coming.
Thank you, Carolyn. And that's it for our show today. We'll see you next Wednesday at 2 o'clock.
All right. Peace.
Take care. Thank you.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Trump ramped up his criticism of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky yesterday after U.S. officials met for talks with Russian officials in Saudi Arabia to discuss ending the war in Ukraine and preparing for a meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Ukraine was not invited to these talks, leading Zelensky to publicly reject any potential agreements made without Kyiv's participation. Speaking to reporters last night, Trump hit back, calling Zelensky a poor negotiator and grossly incompetent, and falsely blaming Ukraine for starting the conflict. The president seemed to be suggesting that the Ukrainians should have made a deal to avoid Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. Zelensky today suggested Trump is echoing Russian talking points and stated that Trump is living in, quote, a disinformation space of Russian propaganda, close quote. In other news, a federal judge yesterday temporarily blocked the CIA and the Office of Director of National Intelligence from firing 11 people who were let go as part of Trump's effort to end DEI programs in the federal government. U.S. District Judge Anthony Trenga issued the order in response to a lawsuit filed by intelligence officers who said the dismissals violated their constitutional rights and federal law. The order doesn't give a detailed reason for the stay, but Trenga said he wanted plaintiffs to give him, quote, clarification as to what agency regulations are implicated in this case and the potential irreparable harm, close quote. Also yesterday, U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan rejected the request of 14 Democratic state attorneys general that would have immediately blocked Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency from firing federal workers and accessing data at 7 federal agencies. Chutkan said the states had not made their case of irreparable harm to justify a temporary restraining order. Judge Chutkan, however, appeared sympathetic to the state's argument that Musk's role is potentially unconstitutional. Quote, plaintiffs legitimately call into question what appears to be the unchecked authority of an unelected individual and an entity that was not created by Congress and over which it has no oversight. Close quote. Chutkan said she found the argument is legally plausible should the states provide more evidence. In other news, President Trump yesterday signed a sweeping executive order bringing independent agencies under the control of the White House, an action that would greatly expand his power but is likely to attract significant legal challenges. The order is expected to apply to the Federal Election Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Federal Trade Commission. Under the order, independent agencies must coordinate policies and priorities with Russell Vogt, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. Vogt will also review and adjust agency budgets.